ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good evening and welcome to PM. I'm Samantha Donovan, coming to you from the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation in Melbourne. Tonight, major European powers rally behind Greenland as Donald Trump reiterates his ambition to take over the Danish territory. Also, bushfires and power outages causing problems as a severe heatwave sweeps across southern Australia. And can child ecologists like six-year-old Angus help save an endangered butterfly?
The purple copper butterfly is pretty rare and we need to help it stay alive.
The children who are becoming familiar with the native black thorn and understanding the butterfly life cycle, they'll be the stewards in the future.
First this evening, the US President Donald Trump is continuing to push his case for an American takeover of Greenland, again saying he'll use military force if necessary. His threat follows the US operation in Venezuela, which saw American troops capture the nation's authoritarian president, Nicolas Maduro. World leaders are drawing a clear distinction between Greenland and the troubled South American country, but many residents of the Danish territory are worried about what's to come. Julia Bergen reports.
United States President Donald Trump wants Greenland, suggesting he's ready to do whatever it takes to get it.
It's so strategic. Right now, Greenland is covered with Russian and Chinese ships all over the place. We need Greenland from the standpoint of national security, and Denmark is not going to be able to do it.
To do that, the US is not ruling out military force. White House Press Secretary Caroline Levitt issuing this statement earlier today.
President Trump has made it well known that acquiring Greenland is a national security priority of the United States, and it's vital to deter our adversaries in the Arctic region. The president and his team are discussing a range of options to pursue this important foreign policy goal. And of course, utilising the US military is always an option at the Commander-in-Chief's disposal.
Here's White House Deputy Chief of Staff Stephen Miller speaking to CNN.
Nobody's going to fight the United States militarily over the future of Greenland.
Diplomatically, however, there has been pushback from Denmark itself, whose Prime Minister Mette Frederiksen says territory should never be exchanged by force. And there's a chorus of disapproval from others in the international community, including Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney.
The future of Greenland is a decision for Greenland and for Denmark exclusively. It's their decision.
German government spokesman Sebastian Hill.
It is quite clear that Greenland is an autonomously administered territory belonging to Denmark. Borders must not be moved by force. Territories must not be annexed by force.
And Paula Pino, spokesperson for the European Union, drawing the link with events in Venezuela in recent days.
Greenland is an ally to the US and is also covered by the NATO alliance. And that is a big, big difference. So we therefore completely stand by Greenland, and in no ways do we see a possible comparison with what happened.
But within Greenland, people are making the comparison.
In light of Venezuela, one has to take it a bit more seriously. It's made us think about what he can do now that he has done what he did in Venezuela.
It's suddenly much more serious at a completely different level. You can see that he simply does whatever suits him, which I find quite disturbing.
It's not the first time that President Trump has indicated the US is after Greenland, but his rhetoric has escalated from Greenlanders having a choice in the matter to now having none.
I think it ties in very much with Trump's general mode of practice, which is to take a sort of maximalist aggressive position and then use that as the basis for negotiation.
That's Dr. Stuart Rollo from the University of Sydney's Centre for International Security Studies.
I'm sure that the United States doesn't actually want to militarily take Greenland, but I think they're very comfortable making the threat with the intention that from there All of a sudden, the purchase of Greenland looks like a relatively attractive offer to Denmark if those are the options.
He says it's a similar conundrum for NATO, not only because a US takeover of Greenland is one NATO ally attacking the territory of another NATO ally, but also because Stuart Rollo believes the US could sink NATO if it doesn't get what it wants.
I would think that if the United States presented this as two options, we're going to purposefully implode NATO at a time when Europe is pretty much engaged in a proxy war with Russia, when it really needs American support. We're either going to do this and you guys are on your own in Europe against Russia, or we can settle it amicably. We can make it look like a win-win, like a great deal, but ultimately the territory is going to come under our control.
Stuart Rollo says it shows the US is pivoting away from a global rules-based order and towards America First.
And this is what an America First foreign policy looks like. It's taking hegemony in the Western Hemisphere and ultimately seeking to ensure that none of their rivals can achieve hegemony in their own regions.
While Greenland grapples with President Trump's intentions, Venezuela continues to deal with the aftermath of its US intervention that saw the country's now-deposed president, Nicolas Maduro, captured alongside his wife, Celia Flores, and flown to the US to face drug trafficking and weapons charges, and former vice president and Nicolas Maduro supporter, Delcy Rodriguez, sworn in as interim leader. President Trump has been clear. The US is running Venezuela. And today he posted on Truth Social that the US will be gifted 30 to 50 million barrels of Venezuelan oil.
This oil will be sold at its market price, and that money will be controlled by me as President of the United States of America to ensure it is used to benefit the people of Venezuela and the United States.
President Trump says that plan is effective immediately.
Julia Bergen reporting. Well, many Australians are enduring searing heat today. From WA through to South Australia and Victoria, temperatures in the mid to high 40s are being recorded, and little relief is forecast before Friday. Bushfires are burning in Victoria, and in South Australia, the extreme conditions have caused power outages, and some energy experts are warning more power blackouts are inevitable. Kathleen O'Connor prepared this report.
In Melbourne's inner suburb of Fitzroy, residents sought a reprieve from what authorities call the most significant heatwave in 6 years at their local swimming pool.
Well, we live really close to here and we live in the inner city, and so any way to keep cool is a good idea.
It's an absolute scorcher, sweating, got the sun cream on, so we'll be all right.
But our house doesn't have aircon, so it's kind of bad.
The mercury is soaring for many areas across the country. Miriam Bradbury is from the Bureau of Meteorology.
Many locations were forecasting top temperatures of 45 or 46 degrees or more. Now, up to about 3:30 on Wednesday afternoon, we have seen numerous locations reaching such high numbers, including in South Australia, Ceduna, Woodna, Port Augusta, Tarcoola, all reaching 46 degrees already.
At the end of the first day of the heat wave comes the first night, with forecasters warning of sweltering, uncomfortable conditions to persist.
The hottest temperatures overnight are really going to be across those very inland parts of the southeast. So we're talking northern Victoria, western New South Wales, and far northeastern South Australia. Those areas may struggle to drop below the mid to high 20s overnight. So really very, very warm conditions.
In Victoria, the State Control Centre has been activated as two major bushfires burn across the state. West and northeast. Residents in Bungle, Granya, and Thurlugalong were told to evacuate. Chris Hartman is from Forest Fire Management Victoria.
These communities again have been impacted at the same community that were impacted in 2020, and it's pretty tough for those communities to deal with more fires in the landscape. That fire is around 1,000 hectares as we speak, and that's likely to continue to grow over the coming days.
Firefighters say the worst is yet to come, with dry lightning and strong winds predicted on Friday. Jason Heffernan is the Chief Fire Officer of Victoria's Country Fire Authority.
We will see yet again a continuation of those mid 40 degree temperatures and an even greater increasing of those very hot northerly winds. Fires under these conditions are uncontrollable. If a fire starts and take hold, it will spread very quickly.
South Australians too enduring difficult conditions. David and Rachel Brown decided to close their Barossa Valley donut shop for 3 days as the area faced over 40 degree temperatures.
We've managed a couple of days like this, that's manageable, but four in a row, you know, from low 40s to mid 40s, it's almost unprecedented.
Temperatures reached 46 degrees in Murray Bridge, a city southeast of Adelaide. Wayne Thorley is the mayor and a local producer. He says he can't operate harvesting machines at the moment.
No one wants to be out in this sort of weather, even playing fireman, to, you know, make sure the community's safe. You know, it's better to be safe than sorry.
Further north, near Hamley Bridge, farmer Simon Maddox is preparing for more searing weather to come.
Going into this time of year, and certainly with days like this, we would have all our fire pumps primed and ready in case we need to respond to an adverse event. And the focus probably for most people is actually on things like stock and making sure that stock have got shade where at all possible and that they've all got access to water, that water troughs have been checked, that they're all full and working, and that water supplies are doing where they need to be.
Adelaide residents also had unexpected power outages. Medisare Marmoudian is director of the Energy Transition Hub at Swinburne University of Technology. He says the power outages will get worse.
If you have the average energy consumption as we've seen in the past years and during the year, I would be very surprised if you don't see a blackout. And the blackout now is going to be very dangerous.
Across much of the Pilbara in Western Australia, temperatures reached over 45 degrees. Residents in New South Wales, northeast Tasmania and Canberra also sweltered through heatwave conditions with temperatures above 30 degrees. The heatwave is expected to persist into Friday before a cool change.
Many of us will be looking forward to that. That report from Kathleen O'Connor and Alexandra Humphreys. The latest figures released today by the Bureau of Statistics show inflation rose 3.4% in the 12 months to November last year. That's down from 3.8% in the year to October. The Reserve Bank has been worried about the inflation rate in recent months, and its next meeting to consider the cash rate is at the start of February. For more on today's inflation figures, I spoke to Sally Tindall, the Director of Data Insights at the financial comparison site Canstar. Sally Tindall, what do you think today's inflation figures mean for interest rates?
Today's monthly CPI results show that inflation is now moving back in the right direction. That is a small win for the RBA. However, it's still noticeably outside of the RBA's target band and a long way from the RBA's actual target, which is 2.5%. So it reduces the urgency for a cash rate hike. However, there is quite a large number of data sets to come through before the RBA meets on the 2nd and 3rd of February. In particular, the quarterly round of inflation data out in January 28th, that will be more comprehensive than the data set we saw today. And I think the RBA will be watching that eagerly to make sure inflation's moving in the right direction. Now, if that data set confirms that inflation is moving in the right direction, the RBA may hold the cash rate at the February meeting, but certainly they won't be entertaining the idea of cash rate cuts. I think that is off the agenda for the foreseeable future until the RBA actually gets this job done and gets inflation right back to target at 2.5%.
Are you able to see from today's figures or interpret why inflation did drop a bit over the year to the month of November?
Yeah, we have seen some noticeable drops in services inflation, in goods inflation. Certainly, there's been a little bit of room there in Black Friday sales as well, which are incorporated in this data set. We see prices drop around the month of November. Electricity also is causing, you know, a little bit of noise, although the RBA will most certainly look through that. But electricity, it went up actually by 19.7% annually, but that was because of the end of the Queensland rebate, which a year ago from that November, households across Queensland were buoyed by a $1,000 bonus handed out by the Queensland government to help with electricity bills.
Sally, what are the economists at the various banks saying in terms of the chance of perhaps an interest rate rise at the February meeting?
So we've still got two of the big four bank economic teams predicting a hike in February. They will also be eagerly reading through the next round of CPI data that comes out just before that meeting, but also the labour force data that comes out on the 22nd of January as well. We do have Westpac and ANZ predicting that the cash rate will stay on hold for the foreseeable future. They are split down the middle in terms of whether the cash rate is going to remain on hold or whether we're going to see hikes in 2026. In fact, NAB is predicting two hikes, and so much of that is dependent on the data that's still yet to land on our desks.
So as a data analyst yourself, what do you think mortgage borrowers should be thinking about as they work out their budgets for 2026?
The probability of a cash rate hike in February has gone down ever so slightly, but that does not mean it's off the cards. And certainly we would expect the RBA board to discuss the possibility of a hike comprehensively at the next meeting in February. And as a borrower, it's important to be prepared for a cash rate hike should one materialise. It might not materialise in February, it might be further into 2026, but it's important to be prepared. So first up, understand what your monthly mortgage repayments would look like in the face of a cash rate hike. Write down that number. Make sure your budget can handle it. Now, the good news is, I accept borrowers do not like the idea of cash rate hikes, but the good news is that a lot of borrowers through 2025 didn't adjust their monthly repayments as we saw those three cash rate cuts in last year. And as a result, they're actually in good stead to handle a cash rate hike or even a couple of cash rate hikes should they materialise.
Sally Tindall is the Director of Data Insights at Canstar. This is PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. You can hear all our programs live or later on the ABC Listen app. As Australians continue to struggle with cost of living pressures, the nation's largest food relief organisation is reporting unprecedented demand. Foodbank relies heavily on surplus stock donated by farmers. But as those growers become more efficient at getting their food to market, there's less for those in need. Ted O'Connor prepared this report.
Shopper Christy Cox struggles to afford healthy food for her young children.
Now that I've got little kids who love fruit, like, I've found that it's really tricky and we've had to sort of cut back the amount of things that we have. So, like, yeah, berries and stuff like that.
Oh, she hasn't sought food relief.
Not at this point, no, but things are very tight.
The regional Victorian is still facing tough choices.
There are definitely some times where maybe I would prioritise the kids over myself during the day, but being pregnant at the moment, like, I can't really do that. But I think if I wasn't, I would probably go without less during the day, for sure.
Foodbank estimates in 20% of Australian households, people skip meals or go whole days without eating. The charity's CEO, Kylie Tink, says hunger in Australia is mainstream, and everyday people are seeking help.
We're seeing more families and individuals need the support of a food bank than ever before, despite the fact we saw the Australian federal government try and provide some cost of living relief measures, rising rental expenses, ongoing mortgage stress that many are feeling. Unfortunately, the thing that they compromise on then is the quality of the food that they're purchasing for their family. And the first thing to go is fresh fruit and veg and high quality protein. So you end up with pantries that are filled with 2-minute noodles.
The food charity relies heavily on farmers donating surplus goods, especially fruit and veggies that have been rejected by supermarkets, but are still fine to eat. Otherwise, it buys food direct at busy times like now. But Kylie Tink says that excess donated food's been drying up as farmers become more efficient at ensuring their entire yield goes to market.
We have a system in Australia at the moment which is set up on repurposing waste, or what is considered waste, to feed people in need. But the quantum of waste is rapidly diminishing as people improve productivity. So that is not a long-term solution either.
Andrew Moon is a veggie grower from Queensland who's been working hard to reduce his food waste, particularly at a time of rising production costs and more extreme weather. But still, occasions arise when supermarkets turn away his produce.
Look, you can get rejections for a lot of different things, but it might be a small percentage of rot. in a 15 kilo crate of product. For example, there may be one onion in that crate that they found with a basal rot or something, and so we have to find a home for that product.
Food banks lobbying the federal government to introduce tax incentives for farmers like Andrew Moon to reduce the cost of freighting that produce to food relief groups, so it doesn't end up dumped and wasted.
Because freight's a big cost. If there's an incentive attached to it, whether it be a tax incentive or whatever, it's always going to be a good thing. It's going to help you make a decision.
The Federal Department of Social Services says it's increased food banks' base funding by almost 70%. But the charity says it needs more than the $1.4 million a year it receives from the Commonwealth so it can buy additional food direct. As these negotiations are thrashed out, people like Christy Cox still struggle at the checkout.
Everything seems a bit pricier than it was before, and I just don't feel like, I don't know, our wages aren't matching really the prices of everything that's going up.
Victorian shopper Christy Cox, that report by Ted O'Connor. Children at a tiny regional school in New South Wales are trying to save one of Australia's most endangered butterflies. The size of a 10-cent coin, the purple copper butterfly lives only in pockets of the state's central tablelands. And the secret to keeping it alive involves a harmonious relationship with an ant, a spiky plant, and the right altitude. Lani Otaway prepared this report.
Well, we're just going to walk probably to the furthest one just over that way because that's where we planted some copper butterfly plants.
Six-year-old Angus is passionate about his iridescent neighbour.
The purple copper butterfly is pretty rare and we need to help it stay alive.
He and his older brother Hayden are students at the tiny Meadow Flat Public between Lithgow and Bathurst in New South Wales. The school's 30 students are on a mission to help the insect. They're planting garden beds with more than 60 saplings of the butterfly's only home, a type of native blackthorn. Hayden says it makes him feel...
happy.
Yeah, why do you feel happy?
Because we get to help them come back to our land.
Alison Cowie is a threatened species officer with the state's Environment Department. She says the butterflies are pretty picky about their living arrangements.
They only live in areas where the native blackthorn exists and only one particular subspecies of it. That plant only occurs at elevations 850 metres and above, and they also have site-specific habitat requirements such as the number of hours of sunlight per day.
On top of all that, the butterflies will only lay eggs if an ant species that looks after their caterpillars lives there too.
Each evening they will emerge from the ant nests where they've been sheltering by day. They'll feed on the blackthorn plants protected by the ants and they'll descend again into the ants' nest by morning.
The ants are compensated for their labour.
They grow a little gland on their back which secretes a sugary honeydew, and that's what the ants use as a reward for their hard work, their bodyguard work.
Alison Cowie says Meadow Flat Public's butterfly gardens are crucial for preserving the species.
Especially when we're talking about younger people in our community, the children who are becoming familiar with the native blackthorn and understanding the butterfly life cycle, they'll be the stewards in the future for this species.
So, yeah, this is where we germinate plants in the polytunnel. You can feel the humidity through the air at the moment as you walk in.
Down the road, Chris Long manages the Lithgow and District Community Nursery, which grows the blackthorn subspecies.
Really the only way that most people can identify if you look under a microscope at the underside of the leaf, and the lasiophylla has a little bit more hairy under the leaf.
That sounds pretty difficult to a layperson.
It's pretty difficult for me.
He says growing the saplings isn't easy either.
Sometimes the other bursaria we've found will grow a lot easier and will come up like a grass in the flat tray, whereas this is a bit more sporadic, not a lot come up at one time.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, that sounds cool. And there's two of them. Hadn't got one, and I got one.
Oh, awesome.
The final challenge is that the butterflies only fly a handful of metres from their existing habitat. Lindsay Foster from Meadow Flat Public accepts they may never reach the school's gardens.
If they ever make it here, that's wonderful.
if they don't, we have a spot ready for them. And we have a place where people can learn a bit more about it. And we're trying to be a centre of knowledge as well.
Knowledge that kids like Angus will carry with them for years to come.
Well, as you know, there's only one planet that usually has life on it. And it's usually just Earth. So we want them to come back to life and stay on our planet.
Wise words there from six-year-old student Angus at the Meadow Flat Public School in the New South Wales Central Tablelands. Lani Otaway, the reporter. Thanks for joining me for PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow. Good night.